Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 273. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is, of course, This Show Is So Gay. And stroll on over to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. A jam-packed show for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Karen Hayes is an award-winning writer, director, producer, editor, and so much more. She is a two-time winner of the TV Pilot Award in the original script competition presented by the Organization of Black Screenwriters. Her first comedic digital series, The World of Corey and Sid, was nominated for Best Television or Web Series in 2009 by the Urban Media Makers Film Festival. She received an Outstanding Writing in a Drama Series Award for her second series, Breaking Point, from the 2011 Los Angeles Web Series Festival. To date, Breaking Point has been awarded, nominated over 20 times, including nods for Best Drama and Best Directing from the 2012 International Television Festival. Her most recent web series, a relationship dramedy dubbed Entangled With You, has already reaped in the awards. Just next week, her acclaimed narrative short, Clean Hands, will be released as a digital download to the whole wide world. I just watched it a few days ago. It's insanely moving. We're going to talk all about it, but before we get to it, Karen Hayes, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So much to chat about. Are you ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
So I described you as a writer, a director, a producer, an editor, so much more. Is there a title to which you gravitate more than the others?
I've been a writer since I was 11.
Okay.
So that was always the goal, and I've just tacked the other stuff on as I've fallen in love with directing as well as producing. The editing is something that came along because of necessity.
Yeah.
Everything else, the so more, is more necessity as well.
If I were to get in touch with your family, and I'm not ruling this out, to try to get my hands on some of your writing from 11 years old, what would I find?
Really bad writing.
Come on!
Yes, yes. I actually have some of it from that time, and I read it, and I see potential, but most of it is just really bad. I would never show anyone.
Listeners, we're going to pause right here, and writer Karen Hayes is going to recite some of her 11-year-old writing. Go for it, Karen. Not so much.
Right.
All right. All right. I tried. You know, we have so many listeners who write in. We have writers on all the time, and they always write in and say, I don't know how to make it as a writer. Let's do a little workshop with Karen Hayes. What advice do you have for our listening audience?
The first advice and most important is write.
Yeah.
You have to start writing. You can't finish something if you don't start it. So just put something on paper. Get it down.
Nice.
And the second thing is read. You know, the more you read, the more you learn, and the more you can improve your writing. You have to know what's good, even reading the bad stuff.
Yeah.
But you have to be able to identify what's good and what's bad in order to, you know, even start to identify it with your own writing. That would be my first two things to do.
Do you have a writing spot? Is there one place where you write more than any other geographical spot?
Yes. That would be my bed.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I have a little desk as well, but I'm a morning bird,
okay.
An early bird. I write the best at 5 a.m.
I don't think that's an actual time on the clock, Karen.
It is. I am most creative in the morning, so generally if I'm really feeling it, I usually go to sleep thinking about it, and I wake up with new ideas or ways to fix problems, so I will wake up and immediately just grab the laptop and start writing.
All right. I would like to put out the theory that if 11-year-old Karen Hayes had woken up at 5 a.m., that stuff would have been optioned already.
I would say that that's not the case.
I'm just putting it out there.
I'm telling you, it was hard.
Well, let's talk about, I mentioned your bio, so many different projects, and I kind of want to go through some of these projects before we get to Clean Hands, which we are going to talk all about. But let's go through some of these projects, and I want you to tell our listening audience what some of these projects say about Karen Hayes. How did you express your voice through them? What did they do for you? So let's start with The World of Corey and Sid. How does that express your voice?
Corey Sid was more, it was less about my voice and more about what was practical.
Okay.
At that time, web series had just started to really, really bloom, and people were starting to talk about them. And the funny thing is I just finished a short film, and I sunk a lot of money into it. And then suddenly, a month later, web series, it's all about web series. No one was doing short films. I was like, oh, my God, are you serious? So I'd already sunk my money into that project, and I had none. So I immediately started to think about what could I do. And one, Corey and Sid is about two roommates who can't pay rent, which was a place I was familiar with.
Okay.
And, that was kind of where it came from. It all takes place in my apartment. We shot 10 days, 5 weekends in a row, and got the series in the can, 10 episodes. And like I said, it was a little less about my voice and more about practicality and how I can get it done.
That's important.
Yeah.
That's important.
Indeed. That was the producer hat. That was less the writer speaking from the heart or anything like that. It was much more, okay, how can we do this
yeah.
and not have me go back to New Orleans
I hear
because
you.
I need to live with my mother.
She would love to have you back. All she does every day is just read your writing from 11 years old, so it's okay. It's okay.
Probably not from 11, but I know she would love me back.
I would like to put out the theory that Breaking Point, though, is much more reflective of your heart.
Probably not.
No, I'm wrong.
You're wrong. It is more so. It is much more what I call my wheelhouse, or what other people call my wheelhouse.
Okay.
Right? But it was Breaking Point is a soap.
Yeah.
And it's all about people cheating and lies and all of this stuff. It's just a bunch of people who, when things don't go their way, they go ahead and find other ways to get their way, which is usually some underhanded way.
Yeah.
So, yes, that is definitely much closer to what I'm interested in as a viewer and as a writer in terms of the relationships and everything else and the drama aspect of it. But in terms of speaking through my heart,
I want to pause right here. Again, listening audience, we're here with Karen Hayes, writer, director, producer, editor, so much more. I want to pause here and be clear that I was not in any way saying that you were underhanded, Karen Hayes. I'm just implying, because I've never called a guest that on the air, I am just implying that I feel like you had fun with this one, though.
I did.
Yeah.
I did. It was a lot of fun, and I wish that we could go back and shoot some more. But Breaking Point took me to the breaking point of my wallet. So
yeah.
if you check it out, it's so vastly different from Corey and Sid. And that Corey and Sid was largely 90% in my apartment. And Breaking Point is, we had, I think it was 37 locations by the end of the
wow.
second season.
Wow. Again, yeah. Want to remind everyone, Karen Hayes, not underhanded. That brings us to, I never thought I had to do that. That brings us to Entangled With You. What does Entangled With You say about Karen Hayes?
Entangled With You, I would say that one is probably my most fun in terms of, well, I don't know if it was necessarily my most fun, but I have a lot of fun doing Entangled With You. We're actually in the middle of the second season right now, and I just love everything about it. We get out a little bit more than we did with Corey and Sid, but we don't have 37 locations like Breaking Point, so I'm not tearing my hair out like
good.
I did
good.
At one point. And, I mean, the cast is so amazing. The reception from the fans, the reactions, it's so amazing. Like, Entangled With You, I would love to just keep doing it. And it's about two roommates, both of them who are in relationships. They separate from their partners, and her girlfriend goes on tour because she refuses to move in with her, and then the other one, her boyfriend gives her VD. And so they break up, and they need roommates. And so Jalea moves in with Alicia, and it's fun. It's all about how their exes, well, Jalea's girlfriend who is on tour, and Alicia's ex-boyfriend, they want complicate their lives, basically. They think that something's going on between the two of them when nothing is going on between the two of them. And it's just a big bunch of awkward shenanigans.
I'm thinking Entangled With You is quite the appropriate title.
Yes, it very much so is.
It's
a drama. It's a comedy. I get to do so many different things. I love to write both drama and comedy. And it's probably, I would say, closest to my heart. But at the same time, any ex I have, I don't want to talk. I don't do that.
After this musical break, we're going to have all of the exes of Karen Hayes, and we'll be talking about her past. No. We have more to talk about. This brings us to Clean Hands, which is a short film. You directed it, you wrote it, you produced it. I assume that you provided the catering for it. I don't know what else you did for this movie. It seems like quite a bit. Before we even get to the plot of it, because it did rip me apart a little and I'm not emotionally prepared yet to talk about it, talk to me about your voice as a director. How would you describe to our listening audience your voice as a director?
I like to bring you into the story at a place where you either can relate to it, you know, doing something that's very universal, or doing something that's going to shock.
Okay.
And this one, it was very much the universal. The ladies are, like the very first scene, I won't give too much away, but the very first scene, the ladies are together, and it's about the two of them. And that's all it's about. And there's an intrusion. And everyone can relate to that.
Yeah.
You know, you're in a relationship, and, you know, that alone time, when that alone time is, you know, stepped on or intruded upon, it's hard.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we go from there. So that's not, I like to pull you in some kind of way so that you are then on the same level and you can feel with them.
I would imagine that, I mean, you knew going in that it was going to be a short, and so it's 20 minutes long, and we'll talk about how folks can access it because they must go watch it. I would imagine that the pressure factor is upped a little bit to draw folks in more quickly because there's not much left of the film.
Right. Yeah, it was very tough. It actually started off as a feature film, or rather the idea was a feature film, and of course I didn't have the budget to do a feature film. So, and I also wanted to get something out immediately that would hopefully bring about an opportunity for me to produce more, which is why we're digitally distributing it as opposed to just putting it out on my YouTube page.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was the immediacy of it that made me go, okay, 20 minutes, let's do it. How can we get everything across in 20 minutes, which is very hard.
I have to tell you, when we're going to get into it, I actually, Karen, I needed to take some breaks. I did not watch it 20 minutes through. And, you know, obviously that's a function of being able to watch it online. But it hit me pretty hard. I needed a couple breaks throughout the 20 minutes.
Really?
I took two breaks, yeah.
Really? Wow.
It's pretty emotional.
It is. It is. I haven't heard that, though. I've heard that it hits people in a lot of different ways. A lot of people take different things from it,
which
is great. I love that. I think there's a saying that says, you don't perceive as things are, you perceive as you are.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
And I'm someone who apparently proceeds with breaks.
Indeed. But yes, everyone takes away something a little bit different. So I haven't heard that take, that it took you had to take a moment to breathe.
Oh, yeah.
Because
that
was definitely one of those things that I thought about in the piece. Like, I wanted it to breathe, you know, 20 minutes. I could have told this story in 15. Because if you notice, we take a lot of moments where we just sink into it and we just let the scene breathe.
Yeah.
Not everyone is, you know, talking over each other. You know, and a lot of filmmakers, they get something, they have a time limit. They just try to talk really fast and get everything out. And I didn't want to do that. This wasn't a story that I wanted to do that with.
Well, let's give listeners a little bit of a synopsis. So and I don't want to give too much away. See, this is the difficulty. If we're talking about a feature film, I could talk about the first 2 minutes. But for you, if I talk about 2 minutes, it's 10% of the film. We have a same-sex couple who are living together. They are caring for one of their ill fathers, and it's fraught. The whole house is quite fraught with emotion. Is that fair to say? How important is it to you to portray a same-sex couple on the screen?
It's very important to me. I think that everyone's story needs to be told.
Yeah.
And while this story wasn't, you know, I've never experienced anything like what they experienced, but I have to take you back to where the story came from.
Please.
So the story came about because I had an idea about telling a story about a couple who were evenly yoked or unevenly yoked, as they say. Like, you are supposed to be with someone who you are essentially on the same page with. And I wanted to tell that story. And for me, I could have gone with a heterosexual couple that were going through these things, but that wasn't speaking to me.
Okay.
So the lesbian couple, they spoke to me. They were telling me things. And I just had to write it down. I had to see it through. And in the end, I loved it. I think that it was so much more poignant as a lesbian couple than it would have been with a heterosexual couple.
Nice. Oh, I'm there. I agree. Now, let's talk about the digital download piece, because this is, I think, a relatively new phenomenon to release films in this way. What prompted you to go this route?
As a web series producer, I have been doing this for a while. I've been putting out content since 2009, just shooting it, editing it, and giving it to the people. And, you know, that's been great, but, you know, it doesn't help me produce the next thing.
Right.
With the internet, you don't have to wait for a yes. You don't have to wait for a studio to reach down and grab you and say, pick you and say, hey, you, it's your time. You don't have to wait for that anymore. You can do it yourself. And so that's exciting to me. And so when I thought about an opportunity to shoot something, to still give it to the people, but still be able to come back and say, this is going to help me do the next thing, that's what made sense to me. To me, it's not about making money. At this point, I have a job that's going to pay my rent. but it's about having the opportunity to produce something else. I'm putting something out there to the audience, and if the audience will support, I'll be able to bring back another project.
Yeah. It's incredible. I mean, the watching of this content then enables more like content, which is a great thing.
Exactly.
It's a great thing. We had your fellow filmmaker, Marina Rice-Bader, was on the show about a month ago, and we talked a little bit with her about being a woman filmmaker in this industry, in your industry. I said this like it's mine. It's not mine, it's yours.
Which
yours is mine. Yeah, there you go. No, I don't think I want yours. I don't think I would survive a day in your industry, so you can have it for this interview. But we talked about the challenges of being a female filmmaker in your industry. Talk to me about your experience of being in that role.
It's hard when I think about the differences and how difficult it is to be a female filmmaker. I think that we all face difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of it can be attributed to being a female filmmaker, but I don't attribute most of it to it. I think that it's difficult for everybody. And it's not easy at all, because for Hollywood, it's less about are you female or are you black or are you white or anything else. It's about who you know and who knows you.
Right.
That's the difficult thing. And a lot of the times they're looking for, I would say the biggest problem that I face in this industry is a lot of times they're looking for that one minority.
Right.
You know, once you have that one minority, then you're good. And that's a problem.
Yeah.
That's where the problem lies. It's, you know, when you look at writers' rooms, you see the same folks over and over and over again, the people who are the veterans, and then you see the one newbie, and usually that newbie is the one minority they have in a room.
Yeah.
And that could be based on the color of their skin, their gender, their sexuality, it's everything. If you get one, then you're good. And so I would say that is the major problem. The fact that I'm a woman is a problem.
Yeah.
in me being able to, you know, step out and get the job, you know.
Well, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about it, and it's a topic that's come up over and over and over again over the past 7 years of doing this show, is just the dearth of people of color in media, you know, of the inability in many different markets for someone to go out there and see people of color in film. And you have a commitment to that in looking at your work. Why is that important to you?
Well, I think it should be important to everyone.
Yeah.
Diversity is so important. Like I said earlier, I think that everyone's story should be told. There is no one person whose story should not be told. I think that entertainment should not only entertain, but it should also enlighten. I think Grey's Anatomy's creator said it best. I was saying it at the same time, but she said it and she's famous, so I think it matters more. But she said it a few years ago, and she was asked, why do I always have gay characters in my shows? And she said that when there were black characters in the shows of the 70s, it made a difference. It humanized people. People who did not know black people were able to get to know black people and realize that black people are just like white people and other people. We're all people. We're all the same. And so that's what I would say. I think it's important to show that, you know, there is no difference, especially with, I don't know if you could tell, but in my writing, I don't write, as we call it, black characters.
Right.
I was actually told that by network that my characters weren't black enough.
It doesn't make for good radio, but I want to be clear that my jaw is still on the table with comments like that. There's just this part of me that's still not. I mean, look, I'm someone who teaches about race and ethnicity on college campuses, and so there's this part of me that's still kind of incredulous that we have these little sectors of our society where you can be told as a writer that your characters are not black enough.
Right. Right. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
It's crazy to me. I don't understand how that could be the case.
Right.
My characters speak a lot like I do.
Well, I will say, just to be clear on the earlier, Shonda Rhimes, not on our show this week, Karen Hayes is, so we're going to attribute that quote to you.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank you.
We're here to help. We're here to help. So tell everyone, now that we've tantalized them, how will they, on August 22nd, be able to access the acclaimed narrative short, Clean Hands?
Well, you can go on our website at hardlyworkingent.com. Hardly working as in hardly working. Are you working hard or hardly working? and you can also see it at realhouse.org. If you just type in Clean Hands, it should pop up.
Okay. And I should ask you, Hardly Working, your entertainment company, how did we come up with the name Hardly Working? Because in reading your bio, it doesn't seem to fit.
That's exactly why. That's exactly why.
Right.
I love that. I was thinking of, okay, I'll actually tell you the real story.
I want to hear the real story. Come on.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of reasons. My mind is just like crazy. It goes everywhere. But honestly, I had about 5 ideas of what I wanted to name my company, and literally it came down to what was the logo going to look like? What was my animated tag going to look like? Because I was so envious. I'm such a TV fanatic.
Okay.
And I love watching the animated tags at the end of TV shows, and I wanted to have something that was really, really cool. And if you've seen my work, I have an animated classroom where where there's a teacher at the board and then a student who's sleeping, a female student who's sleeping at the back of the class. And I was like, oh, my God, that's going to look so cool.
I love it.
And so that's how I ended up on Hardly Working.
I love it. Now, we should say, because you seem to do everything, did you animate it as well? I assume you did.
I did not.
Okay.
I'm a very creative person. I am not that creative, not in that way at all.
All right. All right. I don't really
did
believe
you. Come up with the idea for it.
Of course you did. Of course you did. And you originated that Shonda Rhimes quote. So you're winning in my book. You are winning in my book. Well,
don't
folks,
tell her I said that again.
Yeah, because she's going to call me any minute, Karen, let me tell you. I'm waiting on pins and needles for that call to come through.
And if you, and if she does, pass in my resume. Okay?
I will.
So I
will. Well, everybody can stroll on over to hardlyworkingent.com, and they will be able to download Clean Hands right on August 22nd. I have to be very upfront with you. I watched it twice. The second time I did not need to take breaks because I knew what was coming. But it really hit me pretty hard. And after I watched it, I had to remind myself what you were able to achieve in just 20 minutes. And my hope is that you know it's quite remarkable.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
It's really quite remarkable. It really tugs at the heartstrings. It features so many different sectors of our society and so many different attitudes. And again, in 20 minutes. So it's quite marvelous and a marvel to behold. And so I encourage everybody in just a few days to head on over to hardlyworkingent.com and you can download Clean Hands. What's coming up for you next, my friend?
Well, I'm finishing up the season of Entangled with You. I'm also currently writing what is hopefully my next web series. We will see if it passes my writers group.
Okay.
If they love it, then that's what we'll be doing next. Outside of that, I want to do a feature. That's 2015. That's my goal. So
sounds good to me. And I want to remind our listening audience, next week in Cleveland, Karen Hayes will be here reading her 11-year-old prose. So I'm very excited. I want to start that rumor right now.
Don't do that. People disrespect the people greatly.
They're going to turn out in droves, and I'm just going to play this interview. Karen, again, what a marvelous 20 minutes to spend, and again, what you were able to achieve in that short amount of time. It's fantastic. It's fantastic.
You'll have to tell me what pauses you had to take.
I will. Oh, yeah, I will definitely let you know, but I can't give it away on the air because people on August 22nd are going to go download it. Karen Hayes, what an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
It was great. Thank you, Ken.
If it weren't for your maturity, none of this would have happened. If you weren't so wise beyond your years, I would have been able to control myself. If it weren't for my attention, you wouldn't have been successful. And if it weren't for me, you would never have amounted to very much.
Back. Well, first, I got to return to something I said last week. I got a little bit of flack because I was slightly critical of the gay games. I was just mentioning things other people were saying. I want to be crystal clear on this week's show. The gay games that were here in Cleveland last week were amazing. They were absolutely amazing. By all accounts, there were 8,000 plus athletes and supporters who all descended on Northeast Ohio to both Cleveland and Akron to participate in the gay games, to support athletes. You could feel it in the city. And as someone who lives in Cleveland and was here before the gay games and then was here during the gay games, now I'm living here after the gay games, but I haven't seen as many effects. But before the gay games, it just was different. And during the gay games, rainbow flags were everywhere. They were everywhere. You could feel just the welcoming spirit in the city. You could feel just this influx of 8,000 gay people and allies and supporters of the gay games. It really and truly was an incredible experience. So I apologize if I mentioned any of the negative feedback, of which there was just even a tiny little bit, because it really was an amazing experience to have everybody here and to feel that. all the news stories out there that these 8,000 folks had just the most incredible time. They apparently economically brought something like $40 million to Cleveland. So that's obviously a good thing for our fair city here. But even more important were all the news reports out there and all the anecdotes that these 8,000 folks are going to go back to where they are from, wherever that may be, both nationally and internationally, and just extol the virtues of Cleveland. So hopefully that will make even more strides to make Cleveland an even more amazing place than it already is. So very exciting here in Cleveland. The question is, what will happen now? So many of the rainbow flags have now come down, but I got to tell you, there's still a ton up. There's still a ton up, and we're about 5 days out. So there has been an opportunity to take them down, and folks have not done that yet. So we'll see. We are not a state that has marriage equality. We are not a state that has a ton of protections in particular for our trans brothers and sisters. So hopefully this influx and the attitudes that are in the city right now and just the exposure will lead to some real change, and we could use it. We could use it here in the Ohio. Let's talk about some of the news that's going on out there right now. There is a new campaign out there which is aiming to counter the infamous Westboro Baptist Church's headline-making anti-gay efforts in a tongue-in-cheek way. Right this second, you can go to Indiegogo and you can see that over $40,000 has been contributed to the God Loves Gays billboard project. If the campaign is fully funded by October, God will erect a billboard in Topeka, Kansas, which is the home to the Westboro Baptist Church, which will read, God Loves Gays. The organizers wrote on their campaign's Indiegogo page, quote, God is tired of having hate speech put into his mouth by bigots. The group says their aims go well beyond the borders of Kansas, too. They say, quote, if we raise enough, we could put up billboards in other states as well. Perhaps this will go global. You can stroll on over to Indiegogo.com and just type in God Loves Gays, and you can contribute to this billboard project. You really have to go see what it looks like. I love creativity. I love creativity, and I in particular love artifacts. I love physical artifacts that you can actually see, and it's not just something emotional that we all feel, but rainbow flags and a big cartoon billboard that says God Loves Gays. Love it. Westboro Church in the news. They're in the news. They are trying to spread their message of intolerance with a protest of the late Robin Williams' funeral, but planting peace is not letting the hate take root. So as you all know, Robin Williams just recently died. He was a huge supporter of LGBT rights. Planting Peace, a nonprofit organization founded in 2004 with a mission to spread the love and equality that we all feel all around the globe, they are set on challenging the Westboro Baptist Church's protest with a fundraiser. This group also owns the Equality House, which we've talked about before on the show. The Equality House is situated directly adjacent to the Westboro Baptist Church. It's pretty darn cool. You got to go look up the Equality House and check out what they're doing there. It's literally next door to the Westboro Baptist Church. Aaron Jackson, the co-founder of Planting Peace, he told the Huffington Post this, quote, Robin Williams played many different roles in so many people's lives, and giving back to others was at the top of that list. When the Westboro Baptist Church announced that they were protesting Robin's funeral, we felt like launching a fundraiser for a charity Robin loved, and this would be the perfect way to honor him and counteract the message of hate and intolerance that the Westboro Baptist Church continues to convey, end quote. The proceeds from this fundraiser will go to St. Jude's Hospital, an organization very close to the late actor's death. So far, Planting Peace has raised more than $1,000 of a $30,000 goal via this CrowdRise initiative. So you can stroll on over. If you just Google Planting Peace, this fundraiser will come up for you. I'm so conflicted about the Westboro Baptist Church, not in my disdain for them, but just always thinking, is there a way not to cover them? And am I playing into that right now by even mentioning them? I mean, the theory is I'm talking about anti-Westboro Baptist Church members, and that's how I'm convincing myself that this is okay. I thought about this before I put these stories together for this week's show. And, you know, there are stories out there just about the Westboro Baptist Church's actions and the funerals they're going to protest. And what I decided, this is my route, it's unavoidable to cover them, but what I refuse to do is just cover stories where the Westboro Baptist Church are the main actors in the story. Instead, my commitment that I'm making here on this episode number 273 is to only cover the Westboro Baptist Church when I'm covering stories about people responding to them. You can go, if you click on any of the Huffington Post gay stories this week on their Gay Voices section, they have their top three stories on the top news bar right there, and one of them was just about the Westboro Baptist Church and a notable funeral they were going to protest. And my decision and my commitment that I'm making on this week's episode is, sure, I will mention the Westboro Baptist Church as many other outlets do, but I will only mention them if someone is creating a billboard in opposition to them, or if a group is creating some sort of fundraiser to counteract their messages of hate. So that is my commitment. That is my way of talking about the Westboro Baptist Church without featuring them. Got it? Sounds good, right? We could get everybody else to do that. We would actually knock out some of the other stories about the Westboro Baptist Church in which they are the main actors. It's a good thing. That's a good thing. So many other stories out there. For a good couple seconds, if you had gone to the Brigham Young University bookstore this past week, you could have picked up same-sex marriage cards, greeting cards, right there at the Brigham Young University bookstore. Placed by Hallmark, the cards reading Mr. and Mr. And Mrs. were quickly removed when bookstore staff discovered them after photos surfaced online. The outside vendor stocked the shelves without realizing the school wouldn't want to sell the cards marketed to buyers. This is funny. This is funny. He didn't realize it. He didn't realize the school wouldn't want to sell the cards marketed to buyers celebrating unions between two brides and two grooms. It wasn't immediately clear when they were placed, but the BYU spokeswoman, Carrie Jenkins, said they weren't up long. Thank God. Thank God, Brigham Young University. I was worried those cards were in your bookstore for some amount of time that we could have discerned. BYU staffers have spoken with the company about leaving similar cards off university store shelves in the future. The school doesn't plan on ending its contract with Hallmark. Carrie Jenkins said this quote, this was the BYU spokeswoman, she said, quote, this was just someone stocking the shelves who wasn't aware we've been able to work with them. Asked why they were removed, Jenkins referenced the BYU honor code. It states that while being attracted to people of the same gender doesn't violate the honor code, acting on those feelings is a violation. I love the arbitrary distinction between thoughts and actions. Between thoughts and actions. This is directly from the BYU Honor Code, just so you can hear the actual words. Homosexual behavior includes not only sexual relations between members of the same sex, but all forms of physical intimacy that give expression to homosexual feelings. So if you've had sexual relations, or any form of physical intimacy that gives expression to homosexual feelings, that violates the BYU Honor Code, if you're just thinking them, that's okay. But once you give voice to that or act on it, violates their honor code. By the way, it's funny that the story started out talking about greeting cards. That's where we started, and this is where we've ended up. I do not work at BYU, and there's a reason. And this is it. Just in case you were wondering, why does Ken work at Baldwin Wallace University, which is BWU? Because he doesn't want to work at places like BYU. Just putting that out there. Very cool story. Hundreds of photographs, papers, and historical objects documenting the history of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people are being added to the Smithsonian Institute's collection Tuesday this past week, including items from the popular TV show Will and Grace. The collection includes original scripts from Will and Grace, casting ideas, political memorabilia surrounding the show and the series finale. NBC agreed to donate props, including a pill bottle and flask. That's awesome. A sign from Grace Adler Interior Designs and Will Truman's framed college diploma. The donation is part of a larger effort to document gay and lesbian history, an area that has not been well understood at the museum. Curators are collecting materials from LGBT political, sports, and cultural history objects from Arizona to Maryland. Some items being donated. This is so cool. I love this story. Again, I love artifacts. Some items being donated include the diplomatic passports of Ambassador David Huebner, who is the first openly gay U.S. ambassador confirmed by the Senate, and his husband. Materials from a gay community center in Baltimore, and photography collections from Patsy Lynch and Sylvia Rose documenting gay rights activism. From sports history, the museum will receive a tennis racket from former professional player Renee Richards, who won a landmark, and you have to go read if you've never read her bio. It's fascinating. Renee Richards won a landmark New York Supreme Court decision for transgender rights after she was denied entry to the U.S. Open in 1975. As a big tennis fanatic, it's an amazing read. But it's an amazing read for anybody. Curator Catherine Ott, who focuses on sexuality and gender, said this, quote, there have always been gender nonconforming people in the U.S., and we've made contributions and lived life since the beginning of the country. It's not talked about and analyzed and understood in the critical ways in which it should be. So for us to build the collection, at the Smithsonian means we can more fully document the history of this country. I love it. I love it. The book that I'm assigning for my This Course Is So Gay, which is an actual first-year experience course for credit at Baldwin-Wallace University. We're actually reading a text which I encourage you all to check out. It's called A Queer History of the United States. And it's exactly what curator Catherine Ott is saying. We're not just talking about here's LGBT history. We're talking about here's U.S. history and here's where the intersections of LGBT individuals and LGBT movements and LGBT actions have occurred through U.S. history. And I love this model where we're not just separating it out and saying, this is when Stonewall happened, but we're saying, here's the context for all of it. Here's the larger picture. It's not a separate history. It's part of U.S. history. So that's going to be the Smithsonian. Very, very exciting. People will be able to see that. One quick follow-up on a story that we covered last week. A mother in Iowa is now trying to change the FDA policy after learning that her deceased son's eye donation was rejected because he was gay. We talked about this last week. AJ Betts, 16 years old, took his own life after years of being bullied at school. The teen was a registered organ donor. His mother, Cheryl Morris, said the FDA decided to use some of her son's organs like his kidneys, liver, heart, and lungs, but the federal agency rejected other tissue. She said this quote, "My initial feeling was just very angry because I couldn't understand why my 16-year-old son's eyes couldn't be donated just because he was gay." The rejection, as we talk about every single week, was due to an FDA policy put into place during the height of the AIDS epidemic. It makes would-be donors who are gay ineligible to donate certain tissue if they're believed to have a risk factor for communicable diseases. And the craziest part of the story is that she was asked to prove this mother. Okay, let's pause for a second. Her son just killed himself. Okay, 16 years old. So that's unimaginable right there. And then she was asked, after she was trying to follow his wishes of donating his organs, she was asked to prove that her son hadn't been sexually active with another man in order to honor his tissue donation. This mother of a 16-year-old who had just killed himself due to anti-gay bullying was asked to please prove, really by the government. The government was asking this mother, going through this unbelievable tragedy, to prove that her 16-year-old son hadn't been sexually active with another man, which she obviously was not able to do. Now she is fighting to change the policy. She said this, quote, "This is archaic, and it is just silly that people wouldn't get the life-saving assistance they need because of regulations that are 30 years old. Our support is behind her. We'll try to get her on the show. I'll actually reach out, see if we can't get her on the show. But my God, we need the blood. We need the tissue. And yet, because of these ridiculous policies, this life-saving material is not being collected. Crazy. Crazy. We're going to take a quick musical break, and we're going to be back with more news.
We're having a party, dancing to the music played by the DJ on the radio. The cokes are in the icebox, popcorn's on the table. Me and my baby, we're out here on the floor. So Mr. DJ, keep those records playing, 'cause I'm
all right, folks, and we are back yet again with more news. We now turn to same-sex marriage. And you know, by the way, I want to put this out there. I like being transparent with the way that we cover things on the show. I actually intentionally put the same-sex marriage stuff second because, as I just wrote in the Huffington Post piece, I don't want us just equating victory with marriage equality. There's so many other issues out there. That said, there's a lot going on with marriage equality, and we do have to talk about it because it is important. I'm not trying to downplay the importance of marriage equality. Just want to highlight it's not the only thing out there. Same-sex couples will have to wait longer before they begin marrying in Virginia after the U.S. Supreme Court agreed this week to delay an appeals court ruling striking down the state's gay marriage ban. the nation's highest court granted a request from a county clerk in Northern Virginia to delay a decision by the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond that would have allowed for same-sex couples to marry beginning this week. The state would have also had to start recognizing gay marriages from out of state if the Supreme Court had denied the request. The court provided no explanation for its order. That's, by the way, one of the cool things about the Supreme Court. They don't have to provide an explanation. They could just do stuff like this. The federal appeals court last week refused to delay its decision striking down the ban issued in late July. While it appealed to the high court, the appeals court order did not explain why it denied the request. To be clear, the Supreme Court's decision was not unexpected, as it previously issued an order in January, remember we covered this, putting same-sex unions on hold in Utah while the federal appeals court in Denver was hearing the case. There's just so much going on. That court upheld the decision striking down Utah's gay marriage ban, but delayed its decision from taking effect pending appeal to the Supreme Court. Most other federal court decisions in favor of same-sex marriage also have been put on hold. Again, as I keep saying week after week, these decisions come down and the celebrations are usually pretty short-lived because what goes along with the decision is a stay in implementing same-sex marriage because they give opponents the chance to appeal. And usually the opponents are represented on behalf of the attorney generals of each state. Virginia voters, to give you some context, Virginia voters approved a constitutional amendment in 2006 that banned gay marriage and prohibited the recognition of such marriages performed in other states. The appeals court ruling overturning the ban was the third such ruling by a federal appeals court and the first in the South. So that's a big deal because, you know, it's the South. Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring asked the Supreme Court earlier this month to review a lower court's decision striking down the ban. Herring said that he believes the case will prove compelling to the high court because of the stringent discriminatory nature of Virginia's marriage ban. We like Attorney General Mark Herring. He's a guy who said he will not defend the state's ban and believes the courts ruled correctly in striking it down, which is in contrast with the Florida Attorney General who said, yes, I have to defend it. No, you don't. You actually can make the choice, as Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring has done, to say, I am not defending the state's ban on same-sex marriage. This is not the only thing going on in the court system. There is so much else going on with same-sex marriage. A panel of the 6th U.S. Court of Appeals in Cincinnati, Ohio, recently considered arguments regarding 6 cases from Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Some observers have said that the 6th Circuit may be the first to uphold state gay marriage bans after more than 20 consecutive rulings in the past 8 months, striking them down. So that's going on there with gay marriage. But there's more that's happening. There's more that's happening that we do want to cover. Florida's economy stands to gain a lot from legalizing same-sex marriage, according to a new study from the Williams Institute at the University of California's Los Angeles School of Law. The study estimates that 24,248 same-sex couples would marry within the first 3 years of marriage equality. Costs for vendors, venues, and businesses involved in those weddings would pump, you ready? $182.2 million into the state and local economy, bringing $12,064,815 in total tax revenue from in-state couples and out-of-state guests. The study said this, quote, if Florida grants same-sex couples the right to marry, we predict that the state will see a surge in spending on weddings by same-sex resident couples and their out-of-state guests. Those out-of-state guests are particularly likely to provide a boon to the economy as they and their wedding guests book hotels, restaurant reservations, and leisure activities. The study went on to say this, based on these studies by the Williams Institute, 387,968 out-of-state guests will spend an estimated $42.3 million attending weddings of same-sex couples in Florida during the first 3 years after legalization. So we don't want to boil down equality to economics, but let's also highlight that, hey, it's a good thing. The economy's not doing great, folks. Anything that boosts the economy, like same-sex marriage would in Florida, that would be amazing. And obviously it would do the same in all of these other states. So millions and millions and millions of dollars would be brought to Florida alone if they were to approve same-sex marriage. And then this is the last story about same-sex marriage, about marriage equality for this week's show, amid growing evidence that the anti-gay right wing has lost its battle opposing same-sex marriage, yet another prominent anti-equality voice has conceded that marriage equality will soon be the law of the land. By next year, according to her estimation, Jennifer Roback Morse spent more than a decade affiliated with the anti-gay national organization, first as a spokesperson for California's now-defunct Proposition 8, then as a senior official for the National Organization of Marriage's Marriage Education Fund. She still serves as the president of the National Organization of Marriages backed anti-gay think tank that she founded, known as the Ruth Institute. For the past 20 years, this is her pedigree, Morse has literally made her living by stoking fears about the cultural and economic doom that marriage equality would bring upon the nation. Now, this is what she's saying. You ready? Quote, we're here in 2014 talking about the redefinition of marriage. I'm going to go on the record here and forecast that by this time next year, it'll be over as a legal matter. There will be same-sex, genderless marriage in every state in the union. Obviously, she took that to a fear place. I should have put end quote in the union. Pause. Ken now says commentary. She's obviously putting some fear in there by saying same-sex, genderless marriage, which isn't the case. She then went on to apologize to any Texans in the room, telling them that they are, quote, not going to be able to hold out on maintaining discriminatory marriage laws. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. It's got to be tough. And then I love this quote, good as you, founder, glad correspondent, and an honoree in this year's Advocates 40 Under 40, Jeremy Hooper, tracked down this latest piece of audio, and he said this quote, even I would allow for a two-year timeline, but if Ms. Roback Morse wants to help speed up the inevitable, who am I to stop her? I love that. I love that. So I do want to highlight that The Advocate has released their 40 Under 40, and it's really inspiring, as it is to me every single year. I love it. I love that we're featuring folks who are under 40 who are working so hard to create change, who are working hard to use their own voice to make a difference. So you can stroll on over to advocate.com and check out the 40 Under 40. I love it. I love it. Last story of the week, the Michigan Women's Festival, otherwise known as MishFest. Their organizer, Lisa Vogel, issued a statement about the festival, which just wrapped up its 39th year, and the ongoing controversy around its intention that the festival caters solely to women-born women. In the weeks before this year's festival, a number of high-profile LGBT advocacy groups, including Equality Michigan, GLAAD, the Human Rights Campaign, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and the National Center for Lesbian Rights, they called on the festival to put an end to the women-born women intention. But Lisa Vogel issued a statement, which was emailed to supporters this week with the subject line, "We have a few demands of our own," and it lays out five requests organizers would like to see the festival's critics follow, asking critics to get your facts straight. She delves into the semantics of the word transphobic, and I would encourage you guys to get out there, and you can easily just Google Lisa Vogel's email and check it out. I don't get it. I can't believe that this women's festival is still going on, knowing that, okay, so here's the thing, and I had to correct myself, because what I originally thought was there was this rule. Not that they were checking people at the gate to make sure that you were biologically born a female, but I thought it was much more of an articulated rule. Instead, it's called the intention, and it's more of an expectation. But still, I'm just surprised that this is still going on at this unbelievably amazing festival. Just surprised. A little bit surprised about that. And then you have artists like the Indigo Girls, who you know are the core of my heart, and they have said they don't support it, but they still played there. So there's a lot of work to be done. It's an amazing festival by all tokens, by every account that you hear, but then they also have this intention, which is just so damaging and so surprising given the amazing work that they do. That is the Michigan Women's Festival, and that wraps things up for this week's episode. Our huge thanks to Karen Hayes, and again, I heartily and strongly encourage you to go download her new short film, and you can again go to hardlyworkingent.com and you can download it. It's only 20 minutes. If you take breaks, it'll take you a little longer like I did, but it's only 20 minutes. You can plow through, and it's amazingly moving. Both because it's amazingly moving and even more so given that it's only 20 minutes long. So I encourage you to do so. I will keep you guys posted. My course starts next week, so that's really exciting. So we'll see how these 15 first years respond to This Course Is So Gay and Media Representation of LGBT Culture. very, very excited about that. A ton of amazing guests coming up in the next couple of weeks. We've got some great suggestions, and we would love more. Just send us an email, ken@thisshowisogay.com. Another new thing that we're starting, if you are interested in submitting content, just get in touch with us. We're going to take 5 or 6 minutes if people want to just issue their own commentary. It's this new thing that we're doing. We're going to welcome your voices. We'll be launching that on our website soon. But if you're interested in just recording 5 or 6 minutes, get in touch with me at ken@thisshowisogay.com because we would love to feature you. There are some rules. You can't cuss. You can't cuss. We don't like the cussing. It doesn't work for some of our affiliates. But we would love to feature some more voices, more than just my own and the guests that I have here. So more on that by emailing me, ken@thisshowisogay.com, and I will let you know when our website is updated to reflect that. That brings us to the end of our time. You guys, get out there. Go do whatever it is that you do to use your voice to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
This is the best part of your life. May I suggest this time is blessed for you. This time is blessed and shining, almost blinding bright. Just turn your head and you'll begin to see the thousand reasons that were just beyond your sight. The reasons why I suggest to you, why I suggest this is the best part of your life. There is a address to you, intended only for your eyes. It's a sacred word, like a treasure chest to you, of private scenes and brilliant dreams that mesmerize. A tender lover's smile, a tiny baby's hands, the million stars that fill the turning sky at night. And I